as is commanded.
Please be seated. Before we call the second case this morning, my notes tell me again we have more students from Loyal High School. If that's the case, would you please stand? Oh, wow, wonderful. Please be seated. Well, you are good participants in our arguments this morning. If you can stay when this argument is over, Justice Annette Ziegler, who sits to my right here, will come and chat with the students and really with anybody else who wants to stay about how matters are brought to the Supreme Court, certainly not the merits of the case that is now before us. Also, before I call the case, you'll see the chair on my right, where Justice Shirley Abrahamson generally sits, is empty. She is participating. She is online by phone, and you may hear questions coming out of the ceiling, but it's really Justice Abrahamson participating. So she was very participatory the last argument by phone, and so we will try to be able to adjust our pace among the justices that are present so she does have that opportunity. So with those little preliminary issues out of the way, I will call the second case, State versus Kerr. Are you prepared to proceed? Please do.
Misha Zaitlin, Solicitor General, on behalf of the state of Wisconsin. This court and the U.S. Supreme Court have held over and over again that the judicially created exclusionary rule only applies where the substantial social cost of suppressing probative evidence is outweighed by the social benefit of deterring future constitutional violations by police officers. The U.S. Supreme Court, in cases like Herring and Hudson, has referred to the exclusionary rule as a, quote, last resort, primarily designed to, quote, deter deliberate, reckless, or grossly negligent misconduct by police.
Counsel, you start out with a balancing test. It sounds like cost-benefit analysis.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So let me, since you've kind of queued it up, let me hit it out of this room, not out of the park. Give me the cost-benefit analysis as it applies to the facts of this case.
Right, Your Honor. Both the U.S. Supreme Court, in cases like Herring, and the majority of this court, in the Chief Justice's separate opinion in Scull, have held that the benefit of suppressing evidence where the only misconduct is that of courts is null, that there is no benefit to suppressing the evidence when the only misconduct is by judicial officers.
What about let's say hypothetically, that this wasn't just an isolated event in this county, but it permeated through many counties. I would say a systematic deficiency in approach. What about that cost to the system?
Right, Your Honor, and that could be corrected in this court's authority in direct appeals, in habeas review, and in extreme cases in authority to discipline judges violating the law. It has nothing to do with the exclusionary rule. The exclusionary rule, as this court and the Supreme Court have repeatedly said, is about deterring police because police are engaged in the, quote, often competitive enterprise of ferreting out criminal wrongdoing, and that can cause them in the heat of the moment to sometimes provide affidavits, sometimes go into a home when they don't have a warrant, things of that sort. Judicial officers are, by their nature, neutral, and so they don't need that kind of thing. This court's authority over direct appeals, over habeas cases, and in the extreme cases over judicial disciplinary, fully satisfies that interest.
Here you have a statute.
Counsel.
Here you have a statute that should have been the answer. The language isn't all that problematic. And as a result of that, I think the state has acknowledged that there is a What's the phrase that's used? It's not deficiency. It's worse than that. What is it?
It's void ab initio.
Yeah, I was thinking of something else. Void ab initio comes to mind, but it's really bad, whatever the next descriptive phrase you use. And the state acknowledges that. No, that's based on the statute, if nothing else. It's contrary to the statute. So why isn't the statute sufficient to give notice?
Well, the statute is clear. We submit, and that's why we conceded error with regard to the constitutional violation. And this court faces judges making errors from time to time,
sure.
And it corrects those mistakes in the usual course.
Why would our opinion give any greater emphasis than the clear words of the statute? That's what I'm getting
at. Your Honor, the statute is obviously clear, but the numerous statutes in the areas of court authority, order, arrests are a bit of a muddle. I think once you focus on the specific statute, once you figure out that it's Chapter 800-095, it becomes very clear. But there's a lot of statutes. You see this in the DeBayfield County's Circuit Court's decision. He goes through a lot of statutes, 778, 347. So it may not have been clear there. But I do think that if this court puts in an opinion, the state's concession and this clear statute, this issue will be cleared up. I think that will provide much more immediate guidance to courts than the statute, which is clear on its face, but maybe courts hadn't been making their way to the statute.
But what remedy exists for the individual whose constitutional rights were violated?
Your Honor, in this case, it's a commitment order of 90 days, and if he hadn't had the methamphetamine in his pocket, he presumably would have been imprisoned unlawfully for those 90 days pursuant to a final order of a court. And that is a final order. There is a direct appeal to remedy that constitutional violation, to remedy the fact that the judge had improperly ordered him arrested and imprisoned for 90 days without an indigency hearing. If he hadn't had that separate criminal conduct of possessing methamphetamine, he would have just been jailed for those 90 days under the judge's commitment order, and he would have had a full remedy to challenge that as a final order of the Ashland County Circuit Court and to appeal that to the Court of Appeals, and I submit that he would have had a pretty swift win there. So the fact that he had methamphetamines in his pocket, which led to a different charge, completely unrelated to anything happened in Ashland County, kind of put this case sideways, and of course his dad paid off his forfeiture on the Ashland County matter. The matter that came to the fore was the Bayfield County matter, which was methamphetamine, and had nothing to do with the constitutional violation that he had suffered with regard to the improper commitment order issued by Ashland County.
What if we have a different factual scenario where there isn't somebody who has meth in their pocket, their house is invaded by the police under a warrant that is void ab initio, and the police intrude on their home and go through their belongings and traumatize their kids? What remedy exists for that person?
Well, Your Honor, sometimes there will be no remedy. And for example, let's say they do that and they don't find any criminal evidence of wrongdoing. There wouldn't be any exclusionary rule in the picture at all. So the very nature of the fact that the Fourth Amendment doesn't have a liquidated damages provision or anything else can mean that in certain circumstances there's not going to be a remedy. Sometimes when the misconduct is done by police, you can overcome qualified immunity. Sometimes when the misconduct is done by other actors, and you can have civil suits. Now with judges, it's more challenging. There's absolute immunity there. Oftentimes, when the judge is the one that does misconduct or violates the law, as in this case, there might be absolute immunity and there would be no way to get money damages. But that is, I think, just the very nature of the fact that the United States Supreme Court has said that the exclusionary rule is not a right, it is a last resort.
But then what value does our Bill of Rights have if a government actor can violate that right and there's no remedy for the individual whose right has been violated?
Your Honor, I think that is more of an inquiry for this court's immunity doctrines. If the violation is by a police officer, then you can get a civil lawsuit as long as you can overcome qualified immunity. This court has created absolute immunity for judicial actors. So the problem isn't the exclusionary rule, which deals only in the rare circumstance when the illegal search yields some probative evidence. It's the fact that by common law interpretation, this court and federal courts have granted absolute immunity for judicial actors. So I think that if Your Honor was looking for a solution to that problem, the area to go to would be to deal with some limitation on the various immunities this court has recognized for various state actors, as opposed to expanding the exclusionary rule, which this court and the U.S. Supreme Court has said repeatedly isn't about those kind of considerations. It's just about deterring future constitutional violations. It's not about remedying past constitutional violations. It's only about deterring future constitutional violations and only by police officers.
Maybe you have a little bit of an overstatement when you say this court has consistently, etc. I hearken to the 2010 case written by Justice Prosser, State of Wisconsin versus Hess, which you're asking us to overrule, because this court said something differently than you are maintaining. This court said it isn't exclusively focused on a deterrence for law enforcement. Indeed, that there is a judicial integrity component to the exclusionary rule. So why is the answer only lying in let's take a look at our immunity jurisprudence, which we don't have before us today? Why isn't the answer in addressing the case that we have before us today and the very issue that we have before us today that it can be addressed by making sure that judicial integrity continues as part of the exclusionary rule jurisprudence?
I have two answers to that, Your Honor. First,
one will do.
With respect,
let's see how persuasive
it is. So I have a quibble with the premise of the question. I agree that Hess said what it said, but I think with respect, Hess is an outlier in this court's jurisprudence. As the Chief Justice's separate opinion for four justices, a majority of this court said in Skull in prior cases. And in the U.S. Supreme Court cases, judicial integrity has been ruled out as a standalone basis for the exclusionary rule. And so Hess stands alone, at least in the modern jurisprudence, as establishing that. But just tackling that, your question directly, this is my second answer. I think that it would not be a solution to the problem that you're voicing and that Justice Bradley voicing. The reason for that is the exclusionary rule only comes into play once in a while when these constitutional violations occur. In the typical course, Mr. Kerr would have been arrested and would not have had methamphetamine in the pocket. The judicial integrity or whatever considerations that would go into why that initial warrant should not have been issued, which it should not have been issued, would have remained unremedied regardless of whether this court chooses to depart from the clear statements of the U.S. Supreme Court that the exclusionary rule deals only with police misconduct. So that's what I would say, that if this court is truly concerned about judges in the state violating the law systematically, the exclusionary rule is not the place to go. Because the exclusionary rule only applies once in a while, and only in the happenstance when that illegal arrest is executed, that there's some evidence to suppress or things of that sort. In the vast majority of cases, the unconstitutional arrest will occur, and there will be nothing to suppress. The constitutional violation will have been complete. So I think that it would not be a good step to depart from what the U.S. Supreme Court has said, and with respect to what this court said in all modern cases except for Hess, with regard to the limited scope of the exclusionary rule in order to address that problem, because it would only be addressed once in a while when there is, in fact, evidence found to be suppressed.
So you want to eliminate judicial integrity as a ground for exclusion?
Did you hear the question?
I apologize for not hear the first
it's,
half.
It's Justice Abrahamson, and she wants to know whether you would exclude judicial integrity as grounds for suppression.
Yes, indeed. I would follow what the Chief Justice said in her separate opinion in Scull, which is, quote, the protection of judicial integrity is no longer part of the Supreme Court's analysis. We came to the same conclusion in Easton, and that's paragraphs 56 and 57 of the Chief Justice's separate opinion, joined by a majority of this Court, joined by four justices of this Court. So that is the rule that I would hope this Court
adopts. And therefore you'd overrule Hess?
She wants to know, would you overrule Hess?
Yes, Your Honor. The state's primary submission, and the only way we could prevail before this Court in this case, is if this Court were to overrule Hess.
Okay. And what other cases would you have to overrule?
In order to decide this case, the only modern case that would need to be overruled is Hess. There are some older cases that operate in the background from the 1920s with respect, I think, those cases. And the understanding of the exclusionary rule from those cases has already been overruled by Eason, so I don't think there would be any new overruling. The only case that is still good law that we need to be overruled to decide this case is Hess. And I will note that since Hess has been decided, there's been a decent amount of action in this area. As far as I know, and as far as my research has been able to determine, since Hess was decided, not a single federal court of appeals and not a single state Supreme Court has adopted the point of view that this Court announced in Hess, whereas multiple federal courts of appeals and state supreme courts have adopted the contrary interpretation based on the reasoning that Justice Gilman gave in his dissenting opinion. We have now the First Circuit, the Third Circuit, the Fourth Circuit, the Sixth Circuit, and the Eighth Circuit federal courts all coming to the same conclusion. And I think the Sixth Circuit's decision is particularly telling. The only federal authority that the lead opinion in Hess relied upon was a Sixth Circuit case and a district court case from the Sixth Circuit. The Sixth Circuit, since Hess, has now overruled those cases. That means there is no federal authority supporting Hess, and all of the federal authority is the other way. My friends on the other side, they cite a First Circuit district court case. Since that district court case, the First Circuit has also rejected the point of view of the Hess majority and has adopted, in fact, our position and the position that Justice Gieberman articulated in his dissenting opinion in Hess.
The position being, which you're referring to, that the primary foundation, the foundation for the exclusionary rule since its inception, has been to deter misconduct by law enforcement officers. Not courts.
At least since the Supreme Court's decision in Leon, that has been so. There was some earlier dicta that might have suggested something broader, but since at least Leon, that has been the sole basis for.
And that
counsel, you would overrule Hess, but you would keep Scull, is that right?
I couldn't understand you either, nor can counsel, Justice Abraham. Do you want to try again?
Yep. Position is to get rid of Hess, but that the state still supports Scull. Isn't that correct?
The position is to get rid of Hess, but the state will support Scull. Is that correct?
The Scull decision was correctly decided. There was some verbiage in Scull citing the lead opinion in Hess that prompted the separate concurring opinion joined by a majority of this Court written by the Chief Justice. We are happy to accept Scull, if it incorporates that majority joined concurring opinion by the Chief Justice.
Thank you.
Counsel,
thank you.
The United States Supreme Court has not rendered any decision with respect to the exclusionary rule within the context of a warrant that is void ab initio, has it?
That's correct, Your Honor. But I will note that every federal court of appeals that has interpreted the U.S. Supreme Court decisions, especially in Herring and in Evans, have reached the same position that we urge and that Justice Gilman articulated in the dissenting opinion. And I think that is with good reason. If you think about a case, sorry.
Go ahead.
If you think about a case like Evans, there wasn't any warrant at all. The warrant had been quashed, that had been withdrawn. And even there, and the same with Herring, and even there, the reasonable reliance by police on the inaccurate record in their system that there was a warrant did not justify the suppression. Here, there is a warrant. It's obviously illegal, but if it had been quashed if someone had realized its illegality and it had been quashed and had been accidentally not removed from the system, then you would have the same exact situation as Herring and Evans. That's why all of the federal court of appeals that have considered Herring and Evans have reached the decision that we urge. But I do concede that the U.S. Supreme Court has not had that issue in front of it.
Does the state also concede that the absence of any remedy for an individual whose constitutional rights have been violated presents a threat to the liberty of all citizens?
Well, I hate to be repetitive, but with regard to that problem, that is a function of this court's immunity jurisprudence. Because, like I said, in the vast majority of cases where such a warrant would be issued, or even one where someone, they break into their home as a result of that, assuming that was authorized by the warrant, the fear of the children and all of that, that would obtain, and if no evidence that would be used at a different trial is obtained, the exclusionary rule would be completely irrelevant. Now, of course, if the police officers exceed the scope of the warrant, they go rummaging through people's effects, they do 6 a.m. raids, as unfortunately has happened in the state in recent years, that could be seen as police misconduct, that could be seen as prosecutorial misconduct outside of the scope of absolute immunity, and perhaps there could be remedies under the appropriate circumstances with regard to that within this court's established immunity jurisprudence.
Counsel, I want to follow up on that and play it out. The facts, as I understand in this case, are that the warrant said 90 days. So let me assume, for purposes of my question, that a person is picked up on a warrant that is void ab initio and that is put in jail for 90 days. You're asserting that the remedy, of course, there has to be a remedy, and that the remedy should be found in altering our immunity jurisprudence.
90 days or payment of $298.
Yeah. I may have said something a little bit. In that sort of circumstance where you're saying the remedy would be a direct appeal challenging the 90-day sentence. So there would be a full remedy of release in that sort of circumstance, just to be clear.
You have several times said the remedy lies in us re-examining our immunity jurisprudence, or did I mishear you on that?
That was with response to Justice Bradley's question about what would happen as a result of the actual search, where people might be scared or things of that sort, or the seizure.
Okay.
With regard to the 90 days itself, it's clear that could be challenged under a direct review or habeas. That would be clearly remediable without any excuse.
And what do you mean by a review of our immunity jurisprudence to serve as a remedy? Do you mean suing the judges?
If the only misconduct is by a judge, the only possible remedy could be to sue the judge.
So your answer to Justice Bradley is, let's take a look at our immunity jurisprudence so that you can get money judgments against judges for doing
it. Your Honor, to be
am I right or am I wrong?
Your Honor, to be clear, I'm not urging this court to do that or not do that. I'm just saying that if you want to remedy a problem dealing with a widespread issuance of illegal warrants by judges, the only way to deal with that would be the immunity jurisprudence. I'm not saying the court should, because the exclusionary rule would only arise in a small category of those cases. In a category of those cases, when the evidence of a different crime is seized and is sought to be suppressed. I don't think that there is this widespread problem in the state that would require or militate in favor of this court considering the immunity jurisprudence. My point was the problem of Fourth Amendment violations not having a particular remedy for them in certain circumstances is entirely a function of immunity jurisprudence. It is not a function of the exclusionary rule, which deals with only a small subset of those illegal searches.
First, if you were done responding.
Yes, sir.
First, I think we should recall that, as my memory of the record is, it was 90 days or payment of the $298 and change for the cumulative totals of the forfeitures, I think.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And secondly, before we revisit immunity, a public official, including a judge, does not enjoy immunity for acts taken outside the scope of his or her public duties. So if there's a problem or an issue with a renegade judge out there who is willfully, knowingly violating the law, it seems to me that the remedy lies is already there under the current immunity laws, and that the complainant would have to go through the actual, the real, and the more difficult litigation of establishing and giving the judge the opportunity to go through litigation to justify or explain their conduct in order to determine whether they enjoy the immunity. In other words, was it a mistake or was it willful violation of the constitutional rights of the citizens of this land? The former, we understand. Not one member of this bench, including the one who appears by phone, has not made mistakes. The latter, we do not tolerate. So I'm not quite confident that I think a revisiting of our immunity statutes, to the extent that's within our purview, is necessary. But perhaps if a complainant finds a reason for pursuit of a particular judge, that the vehicle already lies.
Oh, right, Your Honor. And I think even if the money damages action wasn't available in this court's decision in Gabler last term, this court said that we have the authority to supervise judges. A willful violation by judges, that judge could be sanctioned by this court, could be removed by this court. So that kind of thing could be remedied.
Including the monetary sanction. But we held in Gabler that it is this court's province. It is this court's obligation to review the conduct of the judges who we supervise.
That's right, Your Honor. That's right, Your Honor. Now, just briefly, if this court does overrule Hess as the state's primary submission, the resolution of this case is straightforward. Because as the Bayfield County court explained in this case, there was not an allegation of the slightest hint of misconduct or wrongdoing
right.
by police.
Which leads to the other side of the coin, which I expect your opposing counsel will address. What is the stopgap measure then? What is the standard if we adopt their point of view? Do we expect our good and diligent law enforcement officers, our police officers and sheriff's deputies, to somehow become the arbiters of what is and what does constitute a lawfully enforceable warrant as opposed to a detainer order issued as a result of unpaid fines and forfeitures? In this case, it was a no-show. He didn't even show up at court. And so it was a default. And then Judge Eaton, as was the custom many years ago, and Judge Eaton became a judge, it was a long-standing judge, prior to his retirement, not too long ago, for decades, do we expect law enforcement then to decide whether the warrant they just obtained from a circuit court judge is actually one to be enforced or not?
Madam Chief Justice, may I answer the question?
Yes, please.
I do think that is a major problem in their position. The U.S. Supreme Court in Herring and Evans made clear that police officers operating in the field can reasonably rely on the record of a warrant in a computer database. That is all these officers were doing here, and it would be completely unreasonable and disruptive to police practice to somehow have officers second-guess what their computer says, which is that there's a lawful arrest warrant out for this individual.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm John Carlson from Spears, Carlson & Coleman. With us today, we have Chris Kerr. I want to start out by that we should be looking at this case through the lens of the purpose of the exclusionary rule, the terms, and how it applies with cases dealing with exclusion. Principally, we've got three types of cases that we've been looking at through the plethora
the factual, of cases. The factual genesis for this case arises from Ashland County, the issuance of detainer orders for unpaid fines or forfeitures, yes?
Correct.
And those were signed by apparently Judge Robert Eaton, yes?
Correct. Yep.
Well, Have you sued Judge Eaton?
Well, no.
Why not?
Well, because we are dealing with a criminal case here, and while there might be
You're not interested in exploring all possible remedies for your client?
Well, let's look at it. If we went down the route of a civil suit, a 1983 suit, what would that actually entail? Well, you'd have to first sue him probably in federal court, and then you would have to go down the route of having to prove whether or not he has qualified immunity or not.
Right.
And
so would he have immunity?
I don't know. That's not really before this court.
Well,
it's not.
You're saying, and in your brief, you allege dozens, if not hundreds, of individuals must be saved from an illegal scheme at the Ashland County Courthouse to drag people in. And again, I note, well, so if there are dozens or hundreds of people out there who might be subject to illegal detention, it seems to me that you would have at least looked into the idea as to whether Judge Eaton enjoys immunity. In other words, whether he was just doing his job or whether he was intentionally, which is what you would have to prove to pierce immunity, right, violating the rights of the citizens of Ashland County and those who appeared before his court. You must have at least looked into it.
Well, that might be a civil remedy that he has. Okay, but we're here on a criminal case, and we're looking at what remedy he has in the criminal matter.
Right. I understand that. But you must have at least looked into it.
Honestly, I have not.
Okay.
Because I'm not a civil
rights
attorney.
So you're not concerned as to whether it was a simple mistake or whether it was the product of the phrase that Judge Anderson used and my colleague, Justice Ann Bradley, was trying to think of was judicial malfeasance. So you're not interested in actually finding out?
Well, not in the context of this criminal matter.
Doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter in the criminal matter.
Really? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that a judge makes a mistake as opposed to whether the judge is willfully violating the rights of his fellow citizens?
Well, if judicial integrity standing alone doesn't matter, then it doesn't.
Well, but that's not your position at all. That's the opposite of your position.
No. Judicial integrity standing alone, that's in Skull. We acknowledge Skull was decided properly because in Skull, there was a warrant that was issued that at the time was thought to be valid.
Okay. I want to move on to where I left off with your opposing counsel. So what is your idea of how this plays out if we accept your notion that the warrants that are issued by mistake, because absent any showing of bad faith on the part of Judge Eaton or any willful misconduct or malfeasance, but a simple mistake of law, which perhaps you have made from time to time, perhaps I have made from time to time, perhaps every lawyer in this room has made from time to time. I think it's fair to give the circuit court judge the benefit of the doubt, absent a showing otherwise, that it was a mistake.
Well, how would that actually play out in a courtroom?
How does that play out in the real world,
sir? Exactly.
How does it play out? Our good law enforcement officers, including the police and the sheriff's deputies, then is the burden on them to decide whether the warrant is valid?
Well, if you take that position and play it out, then all a police officer has to do is receive word from dispatch that there's an outstanding warrant, and they're good to go. Because we have...
That's the law.
Do you disagree
that that's the current state of the law?
Well, there's still a facially valid requirement.
I'm asking you a direct question, and I'm asking for a direct response. Do you agree or disagree that that is the current state of the law, sir?
It is, unfortunately.
Go ahead.
But I don't think it can stop at that point, because you have to look at how that warrant was was created.
You have to look. Who has to look?
Well, at the point that we end up in the with a subsequent charge, we have to look at why that came about and whether or not the evidence should be suppressed.
Who is the arbiter? Who becomes the arbiter, if not the circuit court judge, who is entrusted in this state by the voters of their county? Judge Eaton, I think, was elected and then reelected without opposition 3 times, in my recollection, by the good people of Ashland County. They must have thought he did a pretty good job. So who then becomes the arbiter, in your view of the world, of whether a warrant that he signs after, and then before that, he was the district attorney of Ashland County for about 15 years. Who becomes the arbiter of whether his warrants are valid or not?
He has to. He has to, but he, in this situation, did not have a prosecuting agency, Ashland County, come
what?
To him. I'm sorry?
I'm sorry, I missed what you said.
Judge Eaton did not have a prosecuting agency such as the Ashland County DA or...
Someone issued the tickets.
I believe it was the city of Ashland. They did not have a city attorney or anyone come to the court and ask for a warrant to be issued. Judge Eaton, on his own, went through the case file, determined that there was non-payment.
Right. So far, the actions of a diligent judge, yes.
And then issued the warrant. But there was no notice given to Mr. Kerr. And, you know, it was interesting in the state's argument about the ability to make an appeal from that final order. Well, that's all well and good, but Mr. Kerr, as pointed out by the circuit court here, by Judge Anderson, didn't receive the notice until a year later. So how do you appeal if you weren't even given notice? And Judge Eaton, while he's also charged with making sure that the warrants are issued are valid, he's also charged with ensuring that Chapter 800 is complied with, that the individual is actually given notice. If we have a child support case and the payer doesn't pay, the judge doesn't go and issue a warrant for the payer's arrest. The party asking for the enforcement of that payment brings forth a motion and affidavit asking for some action.
How do you reconcile your position with the bedrock principle that when we study the history of the jurisprudence vis-a-vis the exclusionary rule, we go back to Map v. Ohio from the 1920s. Barry, the reason it stands out to memory is those of you a little closer to law school than myself, it has very colorful facts. Woman running down a staircase, putting something down her bodice, as it used to be called, but in law enforcement, not being deterred by that attempt to assert privacy. But anyway, be that as it may, from the beginning in the 1920s, the bedrock principle of the foundation of the exclusionary rule was to deter the misconduct, the intentional misconduct of law enforcement. How do you square that with what, and so far I don't hear you disagreeing with me because it hasn't been proven otherwise
that
Judge Eaton was not intentionally violating anybody's rights. He may have made a mistake, as everyone in this room does. So how do you square the judicially created, this is not something in the Constitution, this is a judicially created remedy that, as you know, the United States Supreme Court wrestled back and forth, and they made it advisory, and they warned for a decade or so, we're going to do this, law enforcement, unless you clean up your act. And then finally they pulled the trigger, and they released the exclusionary rule to stem and deter the intentional violation of constitutional rights by members of law enforcement. So how do you say, what is your legal what is your legal basis, a basis in law, for transporting that reasoning to the concept of a judge who makes an honest mistake?
Because in this case, you have a judge who's not acting more as a judge, but initially acting as an officer, doing the investigating as to whether or not payment has been made on a citation.
You're saying by Judge Eaton, who was the judge of Ashland County for many years, the one judge of the county, going through his own files to make sure that they are properly being administered, that is what, law enforcement and not judicial administration?
Well, that's not his job to go through and determine whether or not fines have been paid or not. Well,
let me interrupt you. A circuit court judge makes a lawful court order. Now, you don't disagree that the order, upon default, without explanation, the order to pay the fines or forfeitures was a lawful court order. You agree?
I agree with that.
So a circuit court judge not only has the right, but in my view, has the obligation. Now, the fact that most of them don't like to do it and they don't assign a high priority to it doesn't change the fact that a good and diligent judge will make sure that his lawful court orders are being followed. I don't understand at all, sir, how you can say that takes him out of the judicial realm, because he has the right, and I would say the obligation, to make sure that the lawful court orders that are entered in the name of the people of Ashland County by their duly elected judge are being followed. How does that take him out of his judicial role?
Well, because he is the one who is going in and determining whether or not there has been compliance or not. So if he's going to do that in a civil forfeiture case, then he should also make sure that and enforce that payment is done. Then he should also be making sure that all the other provisions of Chapter 800 are adhered to, and have a indigency hearing, and make sure that the defendant was actually served with notice.
Counsel, the Bayfield County Circuit Court judge had kind of strong words with regard to the issuance of this warrant, which it's now conceded by the state what is void ab initio because it doesn't comport with the law. And he said in part it is judicial malfeasance for the judge to do it. Judicial error on a wide administrative level, because although this case may only be limited to one arrest warrant, he went on to say that the error in this case results in several or dozens or hundreds of arrest warrants. And he focused on a wide judicial error on a wide administrative level. Is it your position that this has been a continuing practice, not only in Ashland County, but on a wide administrative level, or don't you know?
Well, there's no evidence in the record. With that, though, I do know that it is.
Then you shouldn't answer the question.
Not in the record. Please don't help us out, okay?
Sure. Fair enough.
So, counsel, Hess was decided in 2010. The United States Supreme Court a year later decided the Davis case. And in Davis, the court said that the exclusionary rule's sole purpose is to deter Fourth Amendment violations. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
Do you agree that our Hess opinion was based not on deterrence but on judicial integrity?
Primarily.
All right. So do you agree then that the primary justification for our holding in Hess no longer applies?
Well, I think that Hess should survive because the type of warrant in Hess, as in Kerr, there is no statutory basis for it to ever be issued. It is truly a void ab initio warrant.
And what is the significance of the distinction between a warrant that is void ab initio versus one that, say, simply lacked sufficient probable cause?
Well, one that lacks probable cause, theoretically, you have a party seeking to that submits the probable cause statement or oath or affirmation.
Let's put that to aside for a moment. We're just looking at the significance of the existence of a warrant, right? And whether it's defective because it's not supported by probable cause, or it's defective because it did not follow statutory procedures. Why is there a distinction in that with respect to how we respond to evidence obtained pursuant to that warrant?
Well, I'm not sure if I follow you.
Mm-hmm. So that's a good point. Let me just see if I can simplify it a little bit. So two potential reasons that a warrant might be problematic, right? One, there might not have been probable cause to support it, right?
Correct.
And that makes the warrant defective. Two, the procedure may not have been followed to issue the warrant, making it void ab initio. One way or the other, there exists a warrant. The police execute the warrant, and they get information. Why is the nature of the defect significant in deciding what we do with the evidence?
Well, I think it's significant because if the warrant was if there's no basis in the beginning, no statutory basis, then I think that is where the exclusion should occur.
Why is that?
Because in the other cases, like Skull, the NIT warrants, there was theoretically a basis for those warrants to be issued. And in Skull, we had the drug-sniffing dog. In the NIT warrants, we had Rule 41 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, and there was some theoretical basis that later then was found not to be a basis for a warrant issue.
Right, but why is that significant?
Well,
we're dealing with a lack of authority in either case. Why is the nature of the lack of authority bear on what we do with the evidence?
Well, because in a situation where there is a NIT warrant or in Skull where there was a thought to be a basis for it. There isn't any misconduct going on in terms of just wholly not applying law. And then we also have the situations like U.S. v. Evans where we have a warrant that was quashed and not taken out of the system. These are isolated events where deterrence is really not necessary. And, you know, that's where I was going in the beginning here, that the whole principle of the exclusionary law is deterrence. And
yeah.
We don't need deterrence.
Yeah, so let's look at that for a moment. Perhaps you'll recall that the justification for the exclusionary rule was that is a mechanism, it is really the only mechanism by which the one branch of government can encourage another branch of government to comply with the Constitution, right?
Right.
So we say, executive, you're out there violating the Constitution. We can't directly tell you to stop that. But what we can do is say you're not going to enjoy the fruit of your misconduct, and so we won't allow you to use that evidence in our courts, right?
Correct.
Okay. When we deal with judicial errors or perhaps even judicial misconduct, we don't have to do indirect encouragements, right? We can simply order them to comply.
Well, in theory, but we've already had some.
Don't gloss over that too quickly. Let's start with the theory first, right? So it's correct. We don't have to do an indirect encouragement. We can simply order them to comply.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
So you can order them to comply. You can send out a directive. But we've got directives out there. We've got a judicial handbook, a bench book, that says how to follow Chapter 800. There is a DOJ memo that was dealing with this same situation where there needs to be indigency hearings. So there has been some directives out there, not an order, albeit.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do have, Chapter 800, which is law, which should be followed. So That standing alone apparently isn't enough to get enforcement.
So what your suggestion is then is that we tell these courts, instead of court, don't do this, we say court, we're going to punish you by depriving society of useful information.
Hmm? Yes, because I think what this is going, what is going on is that when you have a systematic situation, which there's no case out there that deals with a situation quite like this, where we have a lot of warrants out there.
Well, we don't have that in the record, right?
I'm sorry?
We don't have that in the record.
Well, we've got a case that is in the Court of Appeals that is waiting for this case to be decided.
Okay, that's two.
And we have Judge Anderson in his opinion indicating that that it's widespread, possibly hundreds.
And is that what you're relying on for your
yes.
record basis for
yes.
saying that this is a widespread problem?
Yes.
Okay. Was there evidence in front of the judge to support that comment?
I don't think he. I think what he said offhand was that he's aware of it. As Justice Gableman knows, we have a single judge in Bayfield County and a single judge in Ashland County. So I think that's where he drew that from.
Let me jump in just a moment.
So
wait a minute. I want to ask a question about when Judge Anderson made that finding about a widespread problem. My understanding when I reviewed that part of the transcript was he was cabining that to a widespread problem in Ashland County.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So we don't have a case out there dealing with exclusionary law on where there is a widespread issue. So I think what I think is happening is that while law enforcement is subject to the pressures of the competitiveness of law enforcement, as some of the cases say, I think what is going on at the circuit court level is that they have administrative pressures, and that's why there's a shortcut of not having an indigency hearing and just going ahead with the issuance of the warrant.
Right. So why isn't the proper response to this for you to seek a supervisory writ? Right. So we say supervisory writs are applicable when there is a plain duty. Yeah. And there is no better remedy available. So why not seek a supervisory writ instead of going through this very circuitous route of saying we're going to apply the exclusionary rule to try to indirectly encourage our courts to comply with a plain duty?
Well, because Mr. Kerr was picked up on a criminal and has a criminal charge on him. So I don't think the supervisory writ's going
right.
to do him any good.
Not going to help.
Well, it's not going to help your self-interested client. But if you look at it from the perspective of judicial administration, and if you take an interest in helping and assisting our circuit court judges, then you see it lends a different cast to the whole issue, and it sorts out the mistakes from the ill intended. And I got to tell you, after about just short of 25 years of practicing law in this state, 20 as either a prosecutor or a judge, I've seen some judges who are lemons, but they're trying to do their best. I never doubted that even the losers were trying to do their best and thought they were trying to do their best. So in other words, I understand you are representing your client. And your client has a very narrow, self-interested, self-focused, selfish interest. He wants to escape the consequences of his failure to appear. But from where I sit, the more important question is, how do we determine the proper administration of justice when a judge makes a mistake versus is it enough for you or someone in your client's position to say the judge was wrong. Therefore, all of the evidence that flows from the warrant must be suppressed when there is no, as I see it, no analogous situation between what motivated and the reasoning of all of the early cases which initiated the judicially created exclusionary rule. When, as Justice Kelly is pointing out, we have direct supervisory authority, a writ of mandamus, a writ of supervision, a judicial commission complaint, which we ultimately hear. These are all ways for us to exercise our administrative functions over the circuit court judges if you were actually pursuing the ends and means of making sure there's proper compliance of the judges, unlike the lack of any of those means which existed for law enforcement at the time, which at best were supervised and are supervised by some sort of board that might have some kind of loose supervisory capacity over them.
Counsel, before your time is up, and it's about to be up, you want to give us your very best argument about why this warrant was defective enough that we should not honor the evidence that was found upon search incident to arrest.
Sure. Our position is that Hess should be sustained. First of all, it's only 8 years old, and I think the court should adhere to stare decisis. That's why we do a table of authorities. But Mr. Kerr's case is far worse in that he was never personally served, which means there's no circumstances under which he can be jailed under Chapter 800. The circuit court acted on his own volition. He did the investigation. He issued the warrant. No probable cause or any other facts were presented to him. It completely ignores Chapter 800 in the requirements. And the notice of default judgment wasn't mailed to him until a year later. So in turning to what I believe that the court should do here is sustain Hess and Skull. I don't think there's a need to overrule either one of them, but provide that where there is a systematic issue with warrants being issued illegally or with no basis, that is where the exclusionary rule should apply in Wisconsin. The state did not appeal Hess to the U.S. Supreme Court. And if they so thought that this court was wrong in both Hess and in this case, that could be had. And then perhaps we would have a U.S. Supreme Court that directly addresses void ab initio and the exclusionary rule.
Does there have to be a systemic problem, or is it enough that one individual's constitutional rights were violated?
Well, if we look at U.S. v. Evans, that was a very specific situation, and it's not systemic, and it was a one-time occurrence, and the exclusionary rule probably doesn't need to be used to deter future conduct. So I don't think it needs that, but I think that when there is no statutory basis, that is when there should be an exclusion.
Judicial immunity is not an issue before us, but my understanding of judicial immunity is that when a judge acts within his or her judicial capacity, there is absolute immunity. So that's probably not an avenue. Can you think of any other remedy to vindicate the violation of an individual's constitutional rights here other than what you're asking for in this case or overturning judicial immunity?
I cannot, because not only Mr. Kerr's case is here because of subsequent charges. There are others who don't have the subsequent charges that don't get to this level to have this issue addressed.
What Justice Rebecca Bradley said is true as far as it goes, but unless you can demonstrate, and this is what I started my comments with and my questions with, unless you can demonstrate that the judge has knowingly disregarded his duties under the law, which has not been done here. If you can demonstrate, and you agreed with me when I asked you this at the beginning of your presentation, that to pierce the immunity that would otherwise be extant, one of the ways to do that would be to show, to prove, that the judge knowingly knowingly disregarded his duties under the law and went ahead. For example, if there was a direct order from this court after a writ of mandamus or a petition for supervisory writ, and this court entered an order and said, Judge, you are to stop doing this. It is not in conformity with Chapter 800, et cetera, et cetera. And then the judge continued to do it. That might be one way to show that the judge has so far abandoned the lawful parameters of his office as to not be under the protection of immunity.
Yep. My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I just have one quick point, unless the court has further questions. I think I heard a concession from my friend on the other side to Justice Kelly's question that judicial integrity is no longer a valid consideration under the exclusionary rule of jurisprudence, if it ever was. That was the entire basis for this court's decision in Hess. Once that concession is made, Hess must be overturned. Since there's no allegation of police misconduct here, that should be the end of this case.
What about my concurrence in Hess?
Your Honor, the concurrence in Hess, to the extent it departed at all from the judicial immunity, the judicial misconduct basis for Hess, cited certain cases where judges, justices of the peace, or court commissioners had no authority to issue warrants at all. With respect, once the interest in judicial integrity is put to the side, the distinction between a case where a warrant is void ab initio, a warrant that has been withdrawn but has not been entered into the system is withdrawn, or a situation like Hess, or a situation like this case, there is no difference in those cases. The only inquiry is whether a reasonably well-trained officer would know that problem, whether the officer would know about the problem here.
See, I don't think the officers did anything wrong. The judge issued a warrant that was absolutely lacking of authority in the law, and that's what happened in Hess. So for the person whose rights are violated, they are left without a remedy?
Well, Your Honor, as I mentioned earlier,
if the judicial immunity is not the answer.
No, right, Your Honor, but if the person had had his rights violated and they hadn't had meth in his pocket, he would still have his rights violated to the same extent.
That's right.
And yet there would be no remedy under anybody's lights. So the exclusionary rule doesn't deal with that problem with respect, Your Honor. The exclusionary rule deals with a different issue. It deals with the situation where probative evidence of guilt has been found. And then the Supreme Court has said, what is the rare case where we're going to deprive society, deprive police, of that probative evidence? And the Supreme Court has said in unmistakable language
where that... Where is a warrant that's void ab initio that the Supreme Court has decided the application, if any, of the exclusionary rule?
It is true that the Supreme Court has not faced that. But the federal courts have now had a couple of, almost two decades of now, maybe a decade of applying Herring and Davis. I think it is telling that not a single federal court of appeals, and now we have the 1st, 3rd, 4th, 6th, 8th, not a single state Supreme Court since Herring has agreed with the position of either the Hess-Leet opinion or with respect with Your Honor, separate opinion. Not a single state Supreme Court has agreed with that decision. Every one of them has read the language that Justice Kelly quoted from Davis and the language that Justice Gailman quoted in his dissenting opinion in Hess as foreclosing consideration of judicial integrity, as focusing exclusively on police misconduct. And since there is no police misconduct in a case like Hess or in this one...
When you're done answering Justice Ziegler, I would like to ask a question.
So since there is no police misconduct, and since judicial integrity is taken off the table, the distinction between a warrant that's illegal because of lack of probable cause, like in Leon, or a warrant that has been removed from the system, quashed, like in Evans or Herring, or a warrant that should not have been issued in the first place because it's void ab initio, like in this case or Hess, That is not relevant to police misconduct. That is relevant only to judicial integrity. And as the Chief Justice's separate opinion in Skull points out, which Your Honor did join, the Supreme Court and this Court, except in Hess, has taken away, has made clear that judicial integrity is simply not a valid consideration.
But Skull was not a warrant that was void ab initio.
Right, but I think Skull, the reason there's a separate opinion in Skull, I think, is because Hess is so problematic. It's so inconsistent with the rest of this Court's and Supreme Court's body of law that the mere citation of Hess by the majority opinion in only two places created the impression that somehow judicial integrity is back otherwise. And so it required a separate, I think quite an extraordinary, separate concurrence joined by a majority of this Court. And I think rather than having the situation where we have this aberrant decision out there based upon a judicial integrity rationale that is not the law in this Court otherwise and not the law at the federal level, such that every time it is cited, we need to have a four-justice separate concurrence saying we didn't really mean that Hess's rationale makes any sense, that the much cleaner approach is for this Court to bring itself out of conflict with the First, Third, Fourth, Sixth, and Eighth Circuits. I will also note that your separate opinion in Hess specifically cited the Sixth Circuit's decision as its only federal authority. The Sixth Circuit has since rethought that decision, has explicitly overruled that decision. So there is, while the U.S. Supreme Court has not decided this issue, every federal court of appeals, including the Sixth Circuit, which was cited by both the lead opinion and your opinion, has decided that that's just wrong. Void ab initio, withdrawn, lacking a probable cause. When the police, a reasonably trained police officer, wouldn't have any reason to know that defect, the exclusionary rule simply doesn't apply. Now I see my red light is on.
Chief Justice. Yeah.
Yes, you want to ask one quick question?
Thank you.
Okay. Please.
Now listen, the term has been thrown around, not by me, but it's been thrown around, void ab initio. There are a significant line of cases where warrants have been signed by judges that have sent law enforcement to conduct no-knock search warrants on residences of innocent individuals. They either transposed the street address or they got the apartment number wrong or the floor number wrong. Mm-hmm. And so law enforcement forced their way into those, and we read about them in the newspaper, and we all on the inside, all of us, have a visceral reaction to that. That could be me. And how would we feel if a SWAT team came into our home as we're sitting there watching Law and Order? And my point is, to the best of my knowledge, none of those cases, if they resulted in a plain view of contraband, none of those have ever been quashed, and none of those have ever been called void ab initio because of a mistake.
Right, Your Honor, but I think I agree with you, but I think the broader point here is there's all kinds of reasons why a warrant may be void or voidable. The exclusionary rule focuses not upon the reasons why the warrant is void or voidable, but whether the police reasonably relied upon it. Where there is reasonable reliance by police, the exclusionary rule simply does not apply. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's very, very interesting argument. Both the cases today have been very interesting. The briefing was very helpful, too, so thank you all. We're going to now take a break for the court, and Justice Annette Ziegler will come and chat with any of the students or anybody else who'd like to stick around for a little bit. We are adjourned.